The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Greetings, everyone. I'm Jennifer Green for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazines. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from teenvogue.com. Our first article today from teenvogue.com: Why Must Tyla Repeatedly Defend Her Blackness? This article was written by Caitlin McNabb on June 14th. Tyla is, once again, clarifying and defending her racial identity to the public. On June 13th, the South African singer appeared on New York City's Power 105.1 radio morning show, The Breakfast Club, hosted by controversial hosts Charlemagne the God, DJ Envy, and Jess Hilarious. During the last leg of the conversation, which mostly focused on her global crossover and musical growth, Charlemagne switches gears abruptly from discussing Tyla's work-life balance to her identity. "School me on these debates that they be having about your identity as a South African colored person," the host asks slowly. "What does that even mean?" Without responding, Tyla swivels in her chair to look at a representative from her team. "Can we not, por favor?" her rep interjects from off-screen. "I like that. I like when they talk from the back and say we can't. That's even better," Charlemagne says, while motioning for Tyla to respond on her own. Still composed, Tyla silently turns toward her rep once more. "Next one, please," they ask, signaling for the Breakfast Club hosts to move on, which they did, awkwardly, to a question about Kai Cenat failing to shoot his shot on a recent live stream. A clip of the interaction quickly went viral across social media with polarized reactions. Many came to the singer's defense, citing the Breakfast Club's problematic reputation of provoking lines of questioning and accusing the radio show of engagement baiting. "Every discussion isn't meant for every platform," posted Nathan Vinson, an editor at People. Others criticized the singer's silence and refusal to answer the question, claiming it was fair ground and a missed opportunity to educate audiences with a canned reply. "This is stupid on her team's behalf. Just have a standard answer ready," wrote one person on X. The argument around Tyla defending her blackness arguably began after a TikTok she made in 2020 was recirculated after the 22-year-old Grammy-winning artist found more fame. In the video, she refers to herself as a colored South African, explaining that term means she comes from a lot of different cultures and that in her family, one of those cultures is Zulu. In America, the term colored without the letter U is a slur from the Jim Crow era. Hearing Tyla refer to herself as such has caused confusion and pain among American audience members who are unaware of the history of the term elsewhere in the world. Colored, with a U, is also a vestige of racial segregation. According to BBC, in South Africa, colored people belong to an ancestral, multiracial community legally established during the violent system of apartheid in South Africa, following the Population Registration Act of 1950s, requiring of people to register into one of four racial categories, white, black, Indian, or colored. While colored people received this categorization due to segregation, the colored community have their own language, customs and culture, and diverse collective identity apart from the oppressive history their denomination is tied to. Michael Morris, the head of media at the South African Institute of Race Relations, told BBC that the colored community is quintessentially South African. Being a mixture of black, white, Asian, it was forged in the Southern African geography in a way that no other can claim, Morris told the outlet. From an American understanding, this would mean that colored people are ethnically multiracial or mixed. American social media users have claimed Tyla doesn't identify as black due to her use of the term colored when describing herself, and have expressed frustration around her choice not to call herself black. Tyla herself says she's not black, so why y'all keep calling her that? Wrote one person on X back in May. Following the discourse, Tyla took to X to literally break her silence with a written statement. Never denied my blackness. IDK where that came from. I'm mixed with black/Zulu, Irish, Mauritian/Indian, and colored, wrote the Jump singer. In South Africa, I would be classified as a colored woman, and other places, I would be classified as a black woman. Race is classified differently in different parts of the world. I don't expect to be identified as colored outside of South Africa by anyone not comfortable doing so, because I understand the weight of that word outside of SA, she continued. But to close this conversation, I'm both colored in South Africa and a black woman, as a woman for the culture. It's and, not or. This is not the first or even the second time that Tyla has been asked publicly about her racial identity, and in the past, she's taken the time to elaborately articulate her race and heritage and has even expressed gratitude for her identity sparking global dialogue. In May 2023, pre-water, she explained how stressful it is to refer to herself as colored while in America. I know it's a derogatory term, but that's what we are called in South Africa, she said, while appearing on Dallas radio show 97.9 The Beat. As recently as April 2024, Tyla was asked about the term and her ability to proudly use it to describe her identity during her cover interview for Cosmopolitan. I'm happy there's a conversation happening and that people are learning that Africa is more than just black and white, she answered. Obviously, it gets messy, and no one likes that, but I'm just happy people know we exist and have our own culture. It's important to understand that while Tyla may be one of the most hyper-visible colored public figures, it is not her responsibility to continue to educate media personalities or the general public on the socio-political context of her racial and ethnic identity. Continuously dissecting her blackness within the historical context of a country she does not hail from, and forcing her to repeatedly defend her blackness, is unfair, especially when resources to learn about South African history and the lived experiences of colored people have been widely documented. Author Tessa Dooms stitched a TikTok criticizing Tyla's 2020 video by plugging her book with Lindsay Chutel, Colored, How Classification Became Culture. When people are like, you're denying your blackness, it's not that at all. I never said I am not black. It's just that I grew up as a South African, knowing myself as colored, she continued to Cosmo. And now that I'm exposed to more things, it has made me other things too. I'm also mixed race. I'm also black. I know people like finding a definition for things, but it's and, not or. As young people, we have a platform where we can speak about things like this, things that are new and controversial and scary. Our next article from TeenVogue.com. Florida Democrats hope abortion and marijuana ballot amendments will boost turnout. This article was written by Samuel Lariel on May 16th. This November, Florida voters will have to decide on the future of abortion rights in their state. As Democrats try to leverage abortion to mobilize a reluctant electorate, the party hopes that pro-choice voters, many of whom are young and critical of Joe Biden's candidacy, support the presidential incumbent while trying to protect their rights. On April 1st, the Florida Supreme Court cleared the way for a 6-week abortion ban. That same day, the conservative-leaning judges also approved a ballot measure that could codify abortion in the state constitution if approved in November. Soon after, the Biden campaign expressed a new interest in turning Florida blue, with hopes that the abortion issue can give them a fighting chance in a state that is not the battleground it used to be. "I think that the abortion ballots will bring a big change," says Paulina Trujillo, a member of the University of Florida's College Democrats. "There's a tangible thing that we can vote on. In general, it will be a driving force that could bring people to the ballot." For the past 2 electoral cycles, Democrats in Florida have struggled to generate concrete traction at the state level. In the 2022 midterm elections, when only 22% of young voters turned out to the ballot, Democrats suffered staggering defeats, even in blue strongholds like Miami. But as Alexis Dorman, president of the College Democrats in Florida, sees it, this ballot measure could become a resource to tackle low turnout. "I think that regardless of party affiliation, people support abortion access," Dorman tells Teen Vogue. "Even if they don't support abortion, they don't support the government being involved in their decisions. It really is a selling point for a lot of people to turn out to vote." Still, experts say, in a state like Florida, which has leaned Republican for years, forming a hypothetical pro-choice coalition favorable for Biden's re-election is nothing short of an uphill battle. It's a challenge that is not only contingent on how much money national Democrats decide to invest in the state, but also on the ability of Florida Democrats to execute a compelling on-the-ground campaign. "The fact is, the Democratic Party here is very unorganized, right?" says Lana Atkison, professor of political science and director of the Leroy Collins Institute at Florida State University. "It's just a mess." Atkison adds, "They can't really do a coordinated campaign. So the question is, if they get more resources, are they going to be able to pull it together and campaign on this issue?" While this ballot measure could become a mobilizing event in Florida, pollsters warn that there is no easy way to predict how a presidential election will play out. "Many people believe that abortion could be the silver bullet," says Eduardo Gomara, professor of political science and founding director of the Latino Public Opinion Forum at Florida International University. "But I caution, there are many moving parts in American politics." In addition to abortion, a separate ballot measure that could legalize the use of recreational marijuana in Florida might give Democrats an approach to mobilize young voters in the state, says Gamara. But many factors go into a voter's choice for president. "Most of us are not single-issue voters," says Gamara. "But it looks like abortion is a huge issue." Gamara explains further. "So you have this idea that somehow, if only young people voted, things would change. Well, it looks like when young people vote, they go out and vote in higher numbers, but it's because they're being motivated by something. Maybe a candidate, Obama, for example, or an issue. Maybe abortion is the issue." He notes, "The largest group of voters, the most disciplined group of voters, are people over 65. But again, says Gamara, "we won't know until after November." The increased visibility that protecting abortion or legalizing marijuana brings to the election is likely to have a big effect on local and senatorial races, Atkinson says. But it remains uncertain if state-level measures will heavily influence a voter's choice for president. At the presidential level, things are different, she says. The president is also responsible for the economy, for taxes, and for inflation. To know how an issue at the state level is going to affect voting at the top, that is a little more uncertain. Moreover, issues like Biden's handling of the war in Gaza might motivate young voters to boycott his re-election, perhaps approving ballot measures they support, but declining to cast a ballot for a presidential candidate, a form of protest similar to the uncommitted voter campaign during this year's Democratic primaries. You can say, "I support abortion rights," and "I want abortion rights in Florida," and "I don't like either of these guys," Atkinson says. Especially in more red states, we might see more split votes. There's too much uncertainty because we can separate those choices. Maybe Israel is the important issue to me, or maybe inflation is. Atkinson tells Teen Vogue further, is abortion going to be connected to the presidential campaign? I do think that's going to be a mobilizer. How much? It's going to depend in part on how much that issue is focused on by the candidates in the state. She asks, is Florida going to be a competitive state? Are they, Florida Democrats, going to fight for it? Or are they just going to let it go like they did in 2022? Despite the challenging prospects, Florida Democratic Party Chair Nikki Fried says that new state leadership and an outspoken commitment from national partners to campaign in Florida could help them turn the tide after a series of electoral defeats. The 2022 election book is closed. This is a new Democratic Party, says Fried. We've been able to unite the Florida Democratic Party and all of our coalition partners to get back to the basics, Fried explains. That is talking to voters, doing voter registration, and year-round engagement. Florida has the second largest student body population, second to California, and this is a generation who has a right to be mad. Our national partners, including Biden's campaign, are coming to Florida because Florida is winnable. Fried also points to recent local victories in Jacksonville and Central Florida as proof of concept that a Democratic campaign could still motivate young voters in the state. Experts agree that President Biden could have a fighting chance in Florida if his campaign is able to establish a significant presence before the election. A lot can happen between now and November, says Sharon D. Wright Austin, professor of political science at the University of Florida. As a matter of fact, if you even compare the polls you're seeing now to polls from 6 months or so ago, it looked like the Biden campaign was just dead in the water. It looked like he had absolutely no chance of winning. Austin continues, it all really borders on turnout, and for young voters especially, they will decide the outcome of this election. So if they are really concerned about certain issues, then they really do need to vote and make their voice heard. And also, they need to try to encourage other young people to vote as well. The number of registered Republican voters in Florida has significantly grown since 2020, but the number of independents and Democrats in the state suggests that a competitive race is still possible. I think there's a chance, says Gamara, but it's going to take a heck of a lot more organization and a heck of a lot more targeted strategy. Gamara says that, with a good strategy, wishful thinking might work. But for the Florida Democratic Party, wishful thinking with doing what they've been doing for the past 3 years, it's not going to work. Our next article from TeenVogue.com. Resident assistants at Tufts, Barnard, form unions to improve their jobs. This article was written by Andrew Menjin on May 17th. As my sophomore year at Tufts University comes to a close, I've been reflecting on enjoyable moments and my accomplishments that have occurred over the course of the school year. One of the achievements I'm most proud of is that my union, the United Labor of Tufts Residential Assistants, part of OPEIU Local 153, ratified our first contract. The union contract was the result of about 7 months' worth of negotiating with the Tufts administration over resident assistants' pay, benefits, and working conditions, and we ratified the contract with 96% yes votes. What excites me the most, though, is knowing we're part of a wave of resident assistants organizing at campuses across the country. Resident assistants at private colleges and universities have only had the right to unionize for 7 years. In 2017, the National Labor Relations Board, NLRB, the government agency that has jurisdiction over enforcement of private sector employees' workplace rights, recognized that resident assistants at private schools are workers as well as students and have the right to join together in union. The NLRB reaffirmed this ruling just last year when it recognized the University of Pennsylvania's resident assistants' ability to unionize. Not only can resident assistants organize unions, but we need to form unions for our jobs to be sustainable. It's easy to think that resident assistants are fairly compensated when our housing costs are reduced or fully covered, but we're working a 24/7 job that requires responding to difficult, sometimes even dangerous, situations. Some colleges and universities also reduce or modify resident assistants' overall financial aid packages due to the subsidized housing costs that come with the job, which means many resident assistants on financial aid are essentially receiving less pay than student workers who are not on financial aid. Housing is just one of many expenses for student workers. We still need to be able to pay for food and other basic necessities. Fortunately, more and more student workers are realizing what can be gained by exercising our right to come together in union. In the last year and a half, resident assistants at 12 private colleges and universities, including those at Swarthmore, Barnard, and my school Tufts, have formed unions with the Office of Professional Employees International Union, OPEIU. By negotiating collectively with our administrations, we have been able to address our compensation, safety concerns, lack of transparency, and many other issues that affect our livelihoods and college experiences as resident assistants. Additionally, many resident assistants who are represented by unions have been able to secure holiday pay and extra pay for working over a certain amount of hours. My union contract at Tufts University increased compensation from $0 to a $2,850 stipend with a meal plan, and it improved job security. Our contract also creates staffing ratios of no more than 30 first-year students or 50 continuing students per resident assistant to help foster manageable workloads. Crucially, we are no longer at-will employees who can be disciplined or fired at any time for any reason because with our union contract, we secured just cause protections, which means management must have just and fair reasons for disciplining or dismissing us. All workers, including student workers, deserve to have a say in the terms and conditions of their work. From what I've seen, having a legally protected voice in our workplace has improved morale, working conditions, and fostered more of a community amongst resident assistants here at Tufts. Next year, I will again be a resident assistant, and my union membership largely led me to that decision. I encourage all student workers to think about what you would do with a greater voice in your workplace. Are there needed improvements, or would you like to codify the things you already like about your job? If so, I would encourage you to look into joining together in union with your coworkers. Our next article from TeenVogue.com. Millie Bobby Brown and Jake Bon Jovi are married. This article was written by Vogue on May 25th. Congratulations are in order for Millie Bobby Brown and Jake Bon Jovi. According to multiple reports, the pair secretly married this past weekend in an intimate ceremony. While the location of the wedding is still unconfirmed, the low-key event was attended by the couple's parents, including the legendary musician John Bon Jovi and his wife, Dorothea Bon Jovi. Brown and Bon Jovi have been dating since 2021, when they first connected over Instagram and established a friendship. Romance soon followed, and the pair have made numerous red carpet appearances in support of Brown's acting projects, including Stranger Things and Enola Holmes. In April 2023, Brown announced their engagement via a black-and-white image shared to Instagram, accompanied by a caption that quoted Taylor Swift's Lover. "I've loved you 3 summers now, honey. I want 'em all," Brown wrote. In a 2023 interview with the Sunday Times, Brown shared that Bon Jovi consulted the actor's mother, Kelly, when it came to picking out the ring. "I've always loved that ring. It's always stuck out to me, so she gave it to Jake," she said. "They were in cahoots about the whole proposal. I love that I can always keep a piece of my mum with me." And while this past weekend's wedding was reserved for the couple's closest relatives, it's already been reported that a larger ceremony is set to follow later in the year, meaning there may be plenty more celebrations to come. And there is a note. This article originally appeared in British Vogue. We've run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazines. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jennifer Green, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Teen Magazines is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. We thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.